I don't think he's pretty, for one thing.
I know, but I think the framing and the way he's presented is like sort of the pretty boy version of...
But they're all pretty. Like, they're all played by very hot
They're all pretty boys, Chris.
They're all pretty boys.
Death is always a hot Aryan man.
I guess, like, Death being an all-white kind of pale figure is... That has precedent and establishment, I think.
I guess.
Because Death makes us all pale, in a way.
He's black.
Oh.
Get it?
But our death color is black. And in Japan, it makes sense, because their death color is white.
Right. They hate that there. Also, leaving chopsticks up in rice.
Yeah. True facts?
Yeah.
This is how we learn
it. Is.
No, but I love...
Japan trivia hour. Uh-huh.
Wait... Come again?
You can't leave your chopsticks standing upright in your rice.
I wasn't planning on it, but...
All right, well, don't.
Because it's like incense.
Yeah, it symbolizes... It's like a death thing. Like it...
To do with burning incense.
Right, the incense.
Oh, yes. You're right, sorry. Yeah. Yeah, and so, like, don't do it.
Yep. We all saw Wolverine.
Yeah, that's right. We all did see Wolverine.
Don't do that.
You mean the Wolverine, I believe it was called?
Hugh Jackman, and then he didn't. He learned.
So, you're talking about the one where it's a really cheesy movie set in Japan, but it's pretty fun?
Huh? I think it was cheesy. I wouldn't say it was cheesy.
I thought it was cheesy.
I don't think cheesy is the word I would use. The Wolverine. How is it cheesy, Chris? Explain how.
I just mean,
Chris,
like...
explain how.
It's... Explain
how.
I'll explain it for you with my legs. I'll explain.
Chrissy! You got some splain in the door!
I hit your bongos, Ricky.
This...
chocolate down my blouse.
You listeners are getting quite the treat tonight. But I guess we might as well tell them, Brendan, we're pitching a new version of
I Love Lucy.
Our
I Love Lucy reboot. I'm gonna dig up Lucille Ball's old bones and put them on camera.
Do you know what I always remember? That it's the highest form of comedy ever is that part of Rat Race where like all of the Lucy. No, but they, when they all like the tire goes downhill and they all simultaneously heard it go.
You need to be the shock treatment. Get to jumping like a real life wire. You need a bit of shock treatment. So look out, mister. Don't you blow your last resistor for a sister that'll certify ya.
Hoopla, everyone, and welcome to Why Do We Watch This? The podcast where we watch a bad movie, make a themed cocktail to go along with the movie, talk about what we like, what we didn't like, and then try and fix the movie at the end. My name is Brendan, he's a phenomenon, Drishler.
I'm Lee, you're looking at a goddamned ace, Delahanty.
And I'm Chris, I've just come to tell you how fabulous I am, Ravel.
And the movie we did this episode was 1981's Shock Treatment, the sort of sequel to Rocky Horror Picture Show, also written by Richard O'Brien with songs by Richard O'Brien and directed by Jim Sharman, all of who did the original Rocky Horror Picture Show. Before we get into too much about that movie, let's talk about the drink that we made. The drink that we made is called a Most Bloody Sunset. This was 1.5 bottles of champagne, 1/2 pound of cherries, 1/2 cup of sugar, 6 tablespoons of yuzu juice, and some grapefruit bitters, which I realize now we didn't put in.
Fuck!
Strike grapefruit bitters. So we pureed the cherries and we mixed them with sugar. We simmered it over some heat until the sugar was dissolved, a little bit of reduction. Kept stirring it. Once it was cooled down, we mixed that with the yuzu juice, poured it in a pitcher, and then we added the champagne. And we poured ourselves some glasses of it with some lemon slices for garnish. What'd you think of A Most Bloody Sunset?
I liked it. Now that you're reminding me of the grapefruit bitters thing, I really want to try it with that.
Yeah, I sort of wish we had, but oh well.
I think it would have punched up the flavor a little.
Perhaps.
But I think in general, the cherries was a really nice complement to the yuzu, which I did taste on its own.
Yeah.
It is lemon turned up to 11.
Guys, yuzu is sour.
I liked it. I had a taste, and then my body's been put through the ringer today.
Yeah.
I mean, we've
had a long day of drinking.
I mean, you know, we met some of our fives of fans today at a brunch where we drank gallons and gallons of Prosecco, basically.
Drink a lot.
I'm name drop Franco.
Yeah. Hi, Franco.
And then I fell asleep for like 2.5 hours. Now I'm here.
You just opened your mouth. We threw a bunch of pills down your throat.
You know what?
You out
I was going to say, maybe like...
This is Lee. She's a phenomenon.
Yeah.
Maybe taking a nap after a very decadent brunch and then waking up and watching this movie actually kind of works as an experience.
I feel like it makes as much sense after like a sleepy nap as much as anything else.
Well, because this movie is so dreamlike and weird that...
It is.
I feel like that's fitting.
It is very dreamlike and weird. Mm-hmm. Well, now that we've covered the drink that we done drank, let's go into the movie itself.
The plot of Shock Treatment, according to Wikipedia, is as follows. Continuing from the Rocky Horror Picture Show are the characters of Brad and Janet, now portrayed by Clifton Young and Jessica Harper, respectively, now married. By the way, I'm already kind of disagreeing with this.
Yeah.
The film takes place in the town of Denton, USA, which has been taken over by fast food magnate Harley Flavors, also played by DeYoung. And the town of Denton is entirely encased within a television studio for the DTV Denton Television Network.
I have disagreements with this too, but go on.
As do I. I do not think that that's necessarily the case.
I don't think it's the case at all. Keep going, though.
Residents are either stars or regulars on the show, cast and crew, or audience members. Brad and Janet, seated in the audience, are chosen to participate in the game show Marriage Maze by the supposedly blind and kooky host Bert Schnick, played by Barry Humphries. As a prize, Brad is imprisoned in Denton Vale, a soap opera that centers upon the local mental hospital run by brother and sister Cosmo and Nation McKinley, played by Richard O'Brien and Patricia Quinn, respectively. Janet is given a taste of showbiz as Farley Flavors molds her into a singing diva superstar in an attempt to take her away from Brad. Her compliance is assured through the use of drugs supplied by the McKinleys. Betty Hapshat, man, these names. Betty Hapshat, played by Ruby Wax, and Judge Oliver Wright, played by Charles Gray, investigate Farley and the other people involved in DTV, eventually discovering the Cosmo and Nation are not doctors, but merely character actors. And Farley Flavors is Brad's jealous, long-lost twin brother seeking to destroy Brad and take Janet for himself. The pair rescue Brad from Denton Vale and have Brad confront his twin on Farley's show Faith Factory. They said his show Faith Factory, which makes it sound like it's Brad's. Anyway, Farley imprisons the three and Janet, but they manage to escape in a car along with a local band while the remainder of Denton citizens follow Farley and commit themselves to Denton Vale.
Okay. I mean, that's... I appreciate the brevity of this, but it's also, like, it takes a movie that's already has a very flimsy connection with logic, and it makes it even more confusing.
As we kind of put in while we were reading this, I don't find this synopsis to be terribly faithful to what we saw on screen.
So, okay, I do not either. I chalk a lot of it up to the very ambiguous nature of this movie. There are some things in here that I do think are, like, provably incorrect, almost certainly, but there are a lot of things in here that I think could just be inferred by someone watching the movie because the movie doesn't really spell a lot of this out for you very well.
Yeah, and I think maybe the things I mostly take issue are conclusions. I understand how they got there, but I still disagree.
No, yeah, I agree with you.
We'll get into it soon.
Yeah, so what I will start out with this movie is I have prepared a little Google Doc here with some information as to how Shock Treatment became Shock Treatment. Indeed, to coin a phrase, how did this get made?
I don't know what that reference is.
I don't either. I just came up with it myself. Yeah. I'm a phenomenon.
You're truly the Paul of our group.
This movie began as a direct sequel to the Rocky Horror Picture Show called Rocky Horror Shows His Heels, which was written in 1978 by Richard O'Brien, who wrote the original Rocky Horror Show and played Riff Raff, and in this movie he played Cosmo. The script itself has never been published online, but there are studio notes floating around that recap the story and provide some feedback to the script as submitted to Fox. A cassette tape was also submitted with demo versions of the songs for the movie. Many of these songs were rewritten and used in Shock Treatment. This is a slightly condensed version of the story that is included in the studio notes along with songs. Rocky Horror is miraculously reborn, but Frank is still dead, his corpse badly decomposed. Rocky longs to have Frank revived, song breaking out. Brad and Janet have married and Janet is about to give birth, but Brad can no longer contain his homosexuality and leaves his wife wearing high heels, song Bitchin' in the Kitchen. Brad visits Dr. Scott, also turned gay by Frank. Rocky enters with Frank's body and insists on Scott revitalizing the corpse. Meanwhile, Janet's parents, Emily and Harry Weiss, are shocked to learn that Brad left her. Dad is alarmed to hear Brad's homosexuality, song Thank God I'm a Man. Using their own blood, Brad and Scott helped Frank to be reborn, song Shock Treatment. Frank is delighted to be alive again and even more pleased to learn that Janet is pregnant, as the baby could easily be his as well as Brad's. The next day, Frank, Scott, Brad, and Rocky don their gay apparel, song Little Black Dress. Brad and Scott fight for Frank's affection, but he is absorbed with the idea of his new baby, song I'm Gonna See My Baby. They arrive at the hospital where Janet has given birth to a boy. Frank immediately claims control of the baby and instructs his child about his philosophy of life and tells the gathered people about the party that night. A prize will go to the one with the best costume. Frank and his Transylvanians sprinkle the town with fairy dust that transforms those who are touched into transsexuals. A note, transsexuals here with a capital T being the alien race that Frank is a member of as established by the first movie, not a trans person. A jukebox reminds Frank of Eddie, his old deceased nemesis, and Frank vilifies Eddie in virulent terms, he lived and died for rock and roll song. Suddenly Frank collapses, Brad and Scott's blood wasn't sufficient, he needs 11 pints of the blood of young male virgins and sends Brad to obtain it, song looking for trade. Brad locates some boys who are thrilled to aid an alien celebrity, but one of the boys secretly isn't a virgin. Harry, Emily, a policeman, and a hospital nurse artists or converts to the Transylvanian lifestyle, all wearing high heels and acting lewdly at the party song, Look What I Did to My Id. Meanwhile, two ghostly figures steal Janet's baby from Frank, tell Janet the baby is dead, and wheel Janet out of the hospital. The party is livened by Brad's wild dancing and Frank's singing song, I Wanna Be an Ace. Janet arrives at the party and tells Frank that she loves him and that the baby is dead. Frank is outraged and unmasks the two ghostly figures. They are Riff Raff and Magenta, the pair who killed him in his previous life, song Dual Duet. Suddenly, Frank starts to decompose, realizing one of the boys wasn't a virgin. As he chases the unchased lad, his spell evaporates and the outraged townspeople attack. Riff Raff kills Frank as Brad, Scott, and Rocky barely escape from the angry mob. Riff Raff and Magenta drive off with Janet and her baby. From the baby's rock and roll gurgling, it is clearly Frank's. The studio said the script was imaginative, but the dialogue and plot were fair at best. They liked the songs, aside from I'm Going to See My Baby and He Lived and Died for Rock and Roll, which are the two songs from the demo tape that did not end up in Shock Treatment. They were excited by the idea of having another cult hit, however. They also wanted Tim Curry to reprise his role as Frank. When approached, however, Tim Curry said he didn't want to play the same character again, and Jim Sharman, the director of the first movie, felt the same. At this point, the basic story was thrown out, but O'Brien decided to create a new story using the songs he had written as the starting point. An initial draft was written, and O'Brien took it again to Sharman. Richard O'Brien later recalled, Jim said we made one mistake. I said, what's that? We should have made Janet the lead character. I said, of course we should have done. Let's change the names around on all the dialogue. Oh. You can't do that, said Jim. Yes, you can, I said. Which I wanted to include.
We're already off the races then, really.
Just because I feel like, if nothing else, that exchange really sums up the level of thought that went into this script.
Just, you can't do that.
Just sure I can.
Sure I can. Let me show you. Control, F.
Find Brad. Janet. This became a movie entitled The Brad and Janet Show, which O'Brien finished writing in 1980. Overall, the story was similar to what Shock Treatment became, with the biggest difference being that it was set in the town of Denton and not confined to a TV studio. For example, Denton Vale is the name of an actual asylum in Denton where Brad is committed, not a show. The movie also attempted to make some connections to the first movie, albeit fewer than the older drafts, namely that instead of Bert Schnick, the draft has Dr. Everett Scott from the first movie in this role. Instead of feigning blindness, he is feigning paraplegia. These connections don't always make sense, like there's no reason why Dr. Scott, who was a Nazi scientist turned high school teacher, is now the manager of a TV station that also seems to employ all the returning characters from the first movie. A lot of Brad and Janet's marital issues are also paid lip service to, as they would be in Shock Treatment, but the unspoken subtext seems to be that Brad and Janet's marriage is in trouble because of the events in the first movie, and maybe it has something to do with her career, because that's the actual text. Mm. There's some level of Brad feeling emasculated because he's at home taking care of the housework, and Janet is the breadwinner, which feels really like reminiscent of a lot of 1980s movies, like mm-hmm. Your Mr. Moms and stuff like that, where it's like, but women are working, now what will men do?
Yeah.
This sort of encapsulates a big problem of the later versions of the follow-up. If you're not going to make actual connections to the events of the first movie, you can't just toss in a bunch of half-assed ones, because it makes the follow-up weaker because it's giving a non-committal shrug to Rocky Horror, but it also means that the movie can't seem to make up its mind as to what its own identity is. So aside from this, the script follows the same basic storyline. Tim Curry was once again approached to play Farley Flavors. When he realized he would then have to play Brad also, he turned the part down because he worried he could not do an American accent. Susan Sarandon asked for more money than the budget would allow, and Barry Bostwick also turned down the offer, so they had to recast Brad and Janet. The movie was set to go into production when the Screen Actors Guild went on strike. As such, the movie could not be filmed in Texas as initially planned. To allow the project to move forward, the script was rewritten to take place entirely within a TV studio so that it could be shot on a soundstage in England, creating the movie we have today. That, I also have some weird questions about. For example, why not just film it in England outdoors and say you're in America?
Right.
Like, it's such a weird... weird solution. I
mean, unless they couldn't get a location that was,
I mean, maybe like maybe the budget.
English villages do not look Texan.
No, I know that's true, but also like given that Denton is in a nebulous place, like in the first movie they never explicitly say like it's in Texas. It's just like this is Denton. It's in America. Throw your arms up. Who knows?
But, yeah, so like it had to have been in the 80s a British town that looked suitably suburban enough.
I mean, yeah, like if you just find like
maybe not. I don't know.
A lot of British houses are much older.
That is true, too.
And they have different roofs than we would have.
I also wonder if it was a budget thing, maybe. Like, maybe the budget kept getting shortened down, and eventually they were like, fuck it. Like, we got
leave
nothing.
It in the studio. Yeah. We can't afford a location.
We have a soundstage. Yeah. Let's just go nuts with the soundstage.
And just keep redressing it.
That's right. Use some red lights. The hallways will look a little bit different than they were before.
Oh, God.
So that is how Shock Treatment, which was once the Brad and Janet Show, which was once Rocky Horse Shows His Heels, became the movie that we have watched tonight. It has been a long, weird trip, fellows.
And having heard the way those songs would have been deployed, it makes a lot more sense in their original conception to where
so,
we, I mean, obviously, yeah. Right? Because, I mean, this is no one's first, second, or third choice of an idea of how this movie would have turned out. But it's shocking how, like, how I get the, jokes. The songs really feel out of place in this movie.
Some, not all.
No,
of them
yeah, I would agree. Right. Like some of them are clear. Like I like Breaking Out. I think is really kind of. It's well, it's like a nebulous connection, right? Because
yeah.
it kind of works because it's a song being performed for an audience, so it's like a diegetic song,
right.
And it's covering some business where they're breaking Brad out of the mental institution. So it's like breaking out, we're breaking him
sure.
out. But if you listen to the lyrics, it's about like someone coming to terms, like with
says,
sexuality.
He literally says coming
yeah.
out of the closet.
Yeah,
and it's like oh okay. Well.
And so like a lot of the songs work if you don't pay attention to them. Some of them don't quite so
yeah.
well.
Shock Treatment works.
Shock Treatment works. Anyhow works.
Yeah.
Sort of. In the sense that it's like any
it's an
sort of
ending.
Happy ending would fit Anyhow Anyhow.
Anyhow Anyhow.
Because all it is like, we're going to do it.
Yeah,
we're going to do it.
We're going to keep doing it.
Yeah.
It.
What's it, guys?
Some
is
people
it
do
life?
It this way. Some people do it that way.
Right. Which way? Like, is it
some people do it
are they
here?
Talking
some
about sex?
I have no
because
idea.
They're like, some people do it on the pavement. Some people
yeah,
do it for employment.
Yeah, I think it is sex.
But like, it's such a weird song to be like, now we're going to go fuck.
I guess it's like, we're going to do it anyway.
But that's not even.
So.
But the feeling of the song is just like, we're leaving. I mean, we can get into this in more specificity, but it feels like they're more kind of like, we're throwing off the trauma that we've just incurred.
Right.
We're going to go out and have a good time.
Keep
bye.
Living anyhow,
I think it
anyhow.
Also is supposed to allude to, and me, I mean, the way that I was thought in trying to put it in context in the movie is that, like, they're sort of saying, like, why do we do this? As in, like in general, like, what do you live for? Like, what do you...
Yeah.
Why
yeah.
did we do that? Like, it also has this slight, maybe, connotation of, like, the fact that they just sort of... at least escaped a system, if not
mm-hmm.
worked to overthrow it.
Right.
And it's like, it's sort of maybe hopeful, like, just keep the fight on.
Right.
Yeah, no, it is.
Keep going forward. Keep,
yeah.
keep on doing
anyhow,
it, whatever
anyhow.
That happens to be.
Yeah.
yeah.
Anyhow.
Keep on driving your car into the mists beyond the TV studio.
Yep.
Welcome to Richard O'Brien's Silent Hill.
Yeah.
Stephen King's The Mist.
yeah, that is the direct sequel, actually, to Shock Treatment.
Little known fact.
Yeah. All right, so now that we've covered the background of this movie and tried to explain a little bit as to how it became an actual thing, we were going to go into production values
yeah.
next. So let's talk about the production values a little bit on this movie.
So did it not have a good budget?
I would say it had a small budget.
Okay.
Do you want me to look up to see if they
yeah,
have
go ahead and look up. Just see if it says on Wikipedia how much it
was. If you guys had to guess based on what we see,
I can't guess.
I see, that's the thing, too. I can't really, for inflation, I could not really say. If it was less than 10... Was it less than 10?
Yes.
How much?
It is 3.5 million.
Wow. Okay. Wait, we'll convert that into... Can you
I'm
convert
that
into 2018?
Right
I'm just curious.
Although maybe in 1980 it'll make more sense. Because, I mean, it's, you know, it's been a good 30 years.
We were just heading into Reaganomics, so everything was going to go through the roof.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I don't think it looks that great, if I'm being honest. But, I mean, I don't...
I don't think it looks as terrible as it could have looked.
Yeah.
I do think it looks like they didn't have a big budget, though.
It does look like that, but I also just don't like a lot of the choices, period. I think some of the costuming makes sense, and, like, it works for the story and the imagery.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't like the cinematography at all.
There are some weird... camera choices that happen in
yeah.
this movie. Like we said, there are a lot of extreme close-ups on characters. I feel like the only times I remember thinking that the cinematography really worked for me is there are a couple of tracking shots. Like the overture is one long tracking shot that takes you from like Farley's silhouette all around the studio to people running into
yeah.
the studio to people sitting down, and you see all the major characters either in the background or in the foreground. And I think that's a really nifty opening shot.
That's
and similarly
shot.
Lullaby, the song is done in one complete shot where the camera just moves back and forth outside windows.
Yep, I like that.
Those I liked.
It feels very Music Man-y.
Yeah, it does.
I'm just making sure I'm doing the number right here.
Mm-hmm. Crunch those numbers, Chrissy.
We're talking, that's 3 decimal places, right?
Hmm?
So it's 3,500,000.
I don't know, you're looking at
it. Sorry, that is...
You're looking at an ace.
You're looking at a goddamn ace.
You're looking at a goddamn ace.
That's 9.64 billion. Or million.
What? Yes, wow! Inflation has really kicked off.
9.64 million.
I mean, that's still lower than 10 million today, which is
yeah.
like an absurdly low budget. Like, there are indie movies that are getting made for like a little bit more than that now at this point.
I think there's also an interesting bit of business where there is I do think there's an attempt to delineate between when we're getting... the look at what's happening and the look at how the events appear on the screen to the viewing audience inside the movie. Because it gets considerably grainier when we switch over to the studio feed.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to, like, you know, a standard def 1980s tube
right.
TV where it's like, you know, there's vertical lines across it.
And it's a little fuzzy.
Yeah. Much
but
like myself.
Yes. I mean, likewise. It's interesting to kind of go back and forth between them because even while that makes the... quote-unquote good shots look better, they're still shitty looking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think overall, too, beyond the close-ups and everything, it feels very claustrophobic. I feel like I could shoot a movie on a soundstage and not have it be so obviously, like, wow, there's, like, no room, huh?
At all.
So the one thing I have to say, like, I know it's on a soundstage, but for a lot of the time, I am very confused as to, like, what the layout is of this set. There are many times where, like, I can't work out...
That hallway is boxed
out. Oh, yeah.
Baffling.
Yeah, no,
okay,
like...
Can we talk about the padded hallway, right?
Yeah, all the padded hallways.
It just seems to be you take a few left turns and you get from the insane asylum to the happy home set.
Right.
And they're all in the same white padded complex.
Right.
It feels like it's some sort of interdimensional pathway that you take.
And you go through the gate.
Yeah, it's like a Wonka Vader of the studio.
No, it is. Because, like, similarly, though, the thing is, like, if you had told me that it was shot on a soundstage, like, I don't know, the size of a gymnasium, like a high school gymnasium, I'd be like, yeah.
It.
But if you had also said, like, oh, it was shot on, like, a soundstage the size of a high school, I'd be like, yeah, probably it was. Because, like, just the pathways are so ambiguous. And I'm sure it was done that on purpose to make it seem like it was bigger, but like it becomes hard for me to track where the fuck anything is
exactly
in this movie.
My thought is, I think there would have been a way to, even if you, like, I think it's an interesting idea to be like, consciously, we are always inside this TV studio.
Uh-huh.
And I think there's a way to reflect that in the production values without making it look so weird. Because I agree it's claustrophobic, but not in an interesting way. It feels uncomfortable and it feels like they're cutting around like a cheap line. And
it feels like they're deliberately avoiding certain angles a lot, too.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine it's probably because, like, they didn't have the room, like, or something, right?
My thought is, why not expose those angles? Because if you actually show, like, well, on one side is this, like, very well, quote-unquote, well-produced but glitzy angle, and the other side is just cardboard and wood, that's interesting. I actually think that would have been cool to see the fake lights and the black rafters and all that shit.
I have an insane question as well. In those shots, for example, in the lullaby song,
mm-hmm.
where it's like a brick wall.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like an apartment building or
something. Yeah, and they're on a fire escape.
Right.
Is that... And the way they
are you asking,
it,
like, is this indoors or outdoors?
Is it outdoors?
I don't know! I really don't know! Okay, I thought for the longest time,
can we
set I always assumed they were outside. Because,
yeah.
like... There's, like, a concrete floor, like, a pavement.
Yeah.
And it looks like it's a little wet. Like, it looks like it had just rained there or something.
Yeah.
But, like, on the other hand, when I look up, I'm like, well, it doesn't quite look like the sky is here.
But then does
that... because they don't show anything.
Right, and
sky.
Then he, like, and then Vance Parker, the security guard, turns on lights. And so, like, I guess he could be turning on exterior lights. But on the other hand, like, why would you be turning on exterior lights?
Then he holds up a dead bird.
Right? Does this bird belong to you?
For a joke
which
that
is
doesn't
like,
land.
Is that our...
I mean, it lands for me just, like, not as, like, haha. It's just, like, what a bizarre cap to
is
your
that
scene.
A real dead bird?
Is
that
right?
Wrong
is it a prop dead
yes.
bird?
And who, what dead birds don't belong?
I know.
Don't
just
don't
like where did he find the dead birds?
The other big production values moment I would like to highlight is the "I'm Not Gay" song from
"Thank God I'm a Man."
Thank God I'm a Man. Thank you.
Oh, that does
from
not
Janet's
fit.
Father. I mean, we can get into how that song doesn't work, but the set is so strange for that song. Where he's like pushing. I mean, there's.
It looks
again,
like a cheap high school Greek.
It's AstroTurf.
Yeah, it is AstroTurf.
With these,
like, it's unquestionably AstroTurf.
With these, like, plaster
columns.
Paris columns.
Yeah. One of the many times that columns make an appearance
columns
in this movie.
Yeah,
everywhere.
It looks like a high school Greek life set.
But.
Because there's, like, ivy and columns.
Yeah.
And I'm torn between being intrigued by this maybe being an intentional choice that he's literally pushing his lawnmower over AstroTurf. Because that's, again, an interesting idea of, like, everything in this world is performative,
right.
especially his masculinity.
I mean, like, I sort of like it as the idea that he's just going through the motions and that's all he wants to do. He just wants
right.
to go through the motions of this without
which
actually, like, doing it.
Carries through to his, like, indoor golf kit. Like, he doesn't
right.
want to go to a range. He's perfectly fine.
Like,
this.
He's much happier doing these things in a
right.
controlled environment.
There's something undeniably disappointing by how it looks.
Oh, well, when I had this movie way back in the day on VHS, which I had to buy on Amazon.com when I was in high school, as, like, the first thing I ever bought
wow,
on Amazon was this
legend.
Movie on VHS. Anywho, so I was watching it at a friend's house once, and her mom was, like, walking through the living room as we were watching it, and it was playing that song, and she was just, like, staring. She's like, does he know it's AstroTurf? And she, like, just could not let up with this, and she would just be like, but does he know it's not real? And I was like, man, I don't know what to tell you. If you can't work around that, like,
yeah.
you're just never going to fucking work
well,
around this
problems.
Movie.
And he's living right down the hallway from the insane asylum.
Can we
so, I mean,
talk about how badly that song is shoehorned into the movie?
It is.
Where, like,
the
girl, like, basically they're having a conversation. And
Janet and her mom are having a conversation.
They randomly drop that, like, oh, remember this guy? And he's like, oh, I like that kid. Then you're like, well, that kid actually he ran out of town because he got found with a bunch of Mexican dudes.
Naked.
Naked.
Yeah.
And he's like,
yeah.
he literally goes, like, I have to go.
My planet needs me.
He leaves like he's like shell shocked by this revelation. He sings a song about how he hates gay people.
Yeah.
It's
like a pan to masculinity. Like he's talking about like all the good things that men should be doing, like be the masters of their sisters, indulge in tax evasion.
Yeah, masters of
yeah, it's the masters of their sisters. Men should be the misters.
Men should be the misters.
The masters of their sisters.
Yeah,
I didn't notice until you pointed it out, Lee, that he's just like buffeted out of the room by these words, just like, well, I die.
he's immediately like, I have to process this.
Yeah. Oh, no, I love it also that it's like when Janet goes Mexicans, the moment where he's like, well, now we've gone too far.
Yeah. I wonder if it, I mean, who cares?
Your father really hates Mexicans.
Your father doesn't like Mexicans. The audience just goes like, yeah!
And there almost seems to be a moment, I mean, I thought when I first watched this that is like Janet really trying to rile him up, but she's too, like, the embodiment of milquetoast to really do anything that spicy. But I thought it was also, I lost it. Oh, I wondered in my head if, like, for the dad, it's like, well, a gangbang is one thing and Mexicans are another. But if it's both at the same time...
Put them together. It's a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup, of which I do not wish to be a part.
I short-circuit, and I can't live in this world. Like, anywho.
Production value, I do have to say the one thing about it that I think this movie has going for it. I think it has a stronger visual look than Rocky Horror.
Yes.
I think it has a very consistent visual
look. It's consistent,
look.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a lot, like, as we said on the mini, there is a lot of red and a lot of white in this movie. Whereas Rocky Horror was a lot of, like,
everything.
Dark and, like, opulent furniture and, you know, like, big, ridiculous, overdressed rooms and mansions.
By
this
way,
is a lot of sterile.
It feels like the weakest of compliments you could ever give someone. Like, well, you're nothing if not consistent.
It is a very shady thing to say, right? Like, well, you've been
yes, consistent. At least you've been doing it all this way.
Yeah.
But it is, to be fair, I do think, like, that's a strong suit of the movie.
It is a strong suit.
It's something it does well.
I think we also tend to criticize on this podcast, in a lot of movies have worlds that, I'm not going to use the word coherent with Shock Treatment, but I mean the worlds don't seem to hold up their own internal logic on many levels, and I actually think one of this movie's better strengths is that it does adhere to a very evident internal logic, and I think that's reflected in the production values.
I do agree with you.
The world, nothing looks out of place in this world.
Yeah.
It all looks like it's a part of the same thing.
Everything in this world makes perfect sense in this world.
Yes.
When you try and apply our logic to it, that's when everything falls apart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and God help any of us if we tried to tell you what the rules of this world clearly are.
Yeah, or what's, again,
don't
what's
know.
Happening.
Don't
like,
know.
So let's segue then to plot and characters, which we feel like are kind of intertwined because the characters are pretty thin and don't really stand on their own too much in this movie.
There's a lot of questions.
Do you have one off the top of your head you want to start on?
Can I just rattle off some
questions?
Yes.
Rattle.
Let's just rattle them. Don't answer any of them.
Rattle, baby, rattle.
How long has this town been like this? What point did Farley come into the equation?
Mm-hmm.
Was this a thing before he came in? Like, was there a different sponsor? Because they kind of allude to that.
Or, yeah. Like, also, I would say, like, was the town was obsessed with TV prior to Farley
coming
in?
Yeah, well, that's
so, like,
a question.
That is one of my main ones. Was DTV a mechanism before Farley made it what we see in the
movie? What I would also, I want to throw out real quick, though. The synopsis said that the entire town is a TV studio.
I
do not think that is true.
I disagree.
Because you see people come in at the beginning.
Yes.
I realize that they all spend
but
the
they
night
do
there,
see
which
they
is
do.
Bizarre. I think that's bizarre, and I think it should not happen because it really confuses things.
But
you see them come in, so like they must be coming from somewhere.
I think Denton is a town apart from the TV studio,
right.
But I do think Denton in many ways is subsumed by the TV
studio.
Right,
I think they're all obsessed with the TV studio.
And I think
certainly.
They're along for the ride, and at this point, my conception of it is that DTV has been a thing for a while.
Okay.
I think they kind of like primed the pump of the people of Denton that they're like probably already a little, like, pre-brainwashed. They're all very much going along with this show. And then I think Farley sees this, brings all of his fast food money, buys this mechanism, and decides this is what's taking me to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's really no other way that I don't see another way that can be, because I can't remember her name, but the documentary lady.
Betty?
No.
Oh, Neely.
No, Neely, thank you.
Yeah.
Neely is talking to Brian Janet at the beginning, and they're talking like this has already been happening before their new sponsor Farley has come
right,
in.
That's true.
So this had to have been an ongoing thing.
Okay, so Farley is a relatively recent addition to this.
Yes.
Yeah, but then, like, because we know that Farley is Brett's twin, but, like, when? How did they not know each other?
Right, because you see a picture of them, like, talking about how they were adopted in, like, microfiche.
Yeah, they're the same
but they're,
town.
Like, 3 years
they
old.
They would have known
yeah.
each other.
They're old enough to have remembered that they had a twin.
Yeah.
Unless, like,
and again,
know.
This was front page news. How did no one ever say, like, hey, I remember seeing your picture on the newspaper when you were
yeah.
a child. Whatever happened to your twin brother?
How does he have, like, a different name and, like, no one knows that he's the twin?
I also, the whole newspaper reveal was so dumb, but the whole, like,
well, I mean,
uptown
she,
adoption.
Right, well,
downtown
when Betty goes, enters into like the Plotomatic 5000 of types of McKinley and like, aha!
Character actors.
But they've been changing like, their surnames.
But it was just showing like Johannesburg, South Africa.
Right.
Like it wasn't like
so
giving
actually,
us information.
I have a question about that because I had written down here that I'm unclear as to who people are. Like Betty seems to discover the Cosmo Nation are character actors, which I guess they are, but is their old series, they keep mentioning an old series that
they had in Europe,
is it the same premise as Dentonville? Why do they keep changing their names and just their surnames if they're character actors?
No,
are they hiding from someone? Who are they hiding from? Ancelong, the nurse, seems to imply she was cast because she mentions Short Notice and a bunch of other models when she first shows up.
Yeah.
So I guess she's an actor too. Like, is Ricky? Why does Bert call them quacks and not just say that they're actors?
Yeah.
Like, what?
Because Bert's the one that brought
people?
Them over.
Right.
Too.
So, like, does he know they're actors?
I don't know.
Also, who the fuck is Bert?
Yeah, who is Bert Schnick?
I have a lot of questions about the hierarchy. Like, the order of operations and hierarchy, did Farley hire Bert who hired the quacks?
I think so.
Because
Bert seems to be at the head of all of this.
My inference would be that, like...
the Goebbels.
Yeah.
Actually, here's what I think. If we're running on my theory that DTV was a thing, I think Bert was the head of DTV.
What?
And he was the big star. And
okay,
then when Farley bought it, he became Bert's boss.
I will concede that, like, Bert was probably a huge shit at DTV. I don't think he was, like, the head of it. I think he was probably, like... you know, their program that got the most views.
Moving and shaking.
Yeah,
sure.
And so, like, he probably had some sway, so he was like, hey, I know these people from Europe, like, let's give them a show, too. And
I thought
he just naturally...
also pretty new. Relatively new.
But he was... They he's an established...
Yeah, because everyone loves him, and they know his catchphrases.
But but not, like, as new. All right, maybe I'm, like, extrapolating too much.
No, but please.
Yeah,
there's room.
And,
there's
hey,
space.
Honey, take
I
your pick.
I feel like Bert is the actual main accomplice of Farley, and so that Farley in his takeover of DTV would have planted Bert years before to, get the attention. And then when when it was time for him to take over, that's when Bert then asserts his...
So my assumption would always just be that, like, Bert was kind of just a shit anyway, and Farley just realized that, like, oh, hey, like, I can easily sway this guy to my side.
But
so
Bert
like,
seems into it. And
oh,
he does seem to be, like, if in this hierarchy... I do think Farley's on top. I think Bert is sort of like the assistant manager. And then I think he brought in the McKinleys, quote unquote. And
they're
apparatus.
Basically like, it seems like they're just being played, really. Like, they think they're in charge, but they're
and
really
like, they say,
these.
Like.
But they're making a lot of money.
Right, and
Bert
says, like, that they're, like, willing fools or something.
Right.
Like, they're in on this, but, like, they don't know that they're in on this.
Because he's really selling them on, like, oh, but, like, Farley's gonna make.
Right, everything's
really
gonna be great. Like, your show's gonna run forever.
It does make me think there was maybe the show they had in Europe was a version of Dentonville because they keep acting
like
they've done this so many
times
before.
Coming back to
like
mental health,
right?
Like, they are mental health quacks. It looks like
right, but they're also character actors.
I don't know.
So like
mental health. Quacks?
I wish, see, like honest to God, I wish they had never said they were character actors because I feel
mean,
like
that's really just a line that Betty says.
Right. But it would be so much more simpler if they were just like quacks who kept traveling throughout the world, who constantly were getting caught peddling this fake nonsense and got run out
and
of
then
town.
Would change their names.
Yeah, and then they had to go elsewhere.
Sure.
Also, they're incestuous.
Maybe.
If they are indeed brother and sister.
So when I looked this up online, a bunch of people took the character actor thing as a refutation of the incest. To be like, well, they're unrelated, but they're playing incestual. And I'm like,
so weird.
I'm like, I feel like we're splitting hairs. But
I know, it's just layers on layers.
This movie is like that, so maybe. I don't know.
It just bombards you with so much crap that like you can't... I feel like you can't even take it all in one go. Like, you just have to sort of keep running along with it.
Thank God we watched these movies twice.
Yeah.
I have a question about Bert.
Okay.
What the fuck is Marriage Maze? Is it?
Yeah,
I have to be honest
like,
with you.
There's no shows.
Yeah.
They just invite a couple on.
They get on. And they're like, all
right. He berates them. They just pick one of them, I guess, to be like...
committed.
Go to Dentonville. Yeah. Chris, I have to tell you, before you said, like, do they go into the Marriage Maze... I never for a minute considered that that was an actual thing. I always thought it was like a metaphor. But now that you say it, I'm like, oh, maybe that is like a game show and you have to like find your spouse in the marriage maze. Like,
I thought it was something. I thought
sense.
The maze was at least, if it not an actual maze, like a quiz.
Right.
Yeah, like I didn't think it was like
nothing.
A physical maze, but like now that you say it, I'm like, oh, maybe. Like it does seem like it's a game show of some sort.
Yeah.
Because they show Harry and Emily, Janet's parents, on and they have like a 30-second countdown. And he's like, your clue is mental instability.
Right.
And they get the right answer and then they go to spend time at the Happy Homes set, which is like a reality show where you have a nice house.
They don't specify really what the quiz was, but I guess you're supposed to infer that they're supposed to figure out what the root of his mental
instability
is.
Like it was just like you cut back to them, other nonsense
had
been said.
Yeah, you didn't hear the beginning of it.
Yeah, okay. But like you come back and they've been going through this for 5 minutes and now they have their last clue and you
because God
seconds.
Forbid that you like shit any context.
Yeah, I know. God forbid you set up anything. I keep, every time like I watch this and I think about the setup for this, I keep thinking about Fury Road and how Fury Road does such a great job of like giving you just enough and setting up this entire world and allowing you to make inferences where they like they're not like your inferences don't affect the story in any way,
right.
Like they just affect how you think this world happened. This movie like gives you nothing but also doesn't let you set up any inferences of your own, like as far as the plot goes. It's like, do you think this, maybe this is what happened, but it will be contradicted by this.
There's this one line that Chris and I really latched onto that Bert says at one point about like if it might have would have thrown you in the Danube.
Yeah, they should be taken to the Danube at dawn.
Yeah. And we were like, so is he like an ex-Nazi scientist? Like what's going on with him?
It feels like he was like in the SS and he was like drowning people.
I mean,
you
said that like it was the
right
because
that's the thing because it was Dr. Scott initially who was like
right.
So
they
say in Rocky Horror
maybe they kept that line and
I mean,
forgot.
Honest to God, so here's the thing also, so in the original original Rocky Horror, Dr. Scott's in a wheelchair, like that's his thing, and then in this movie they establish like he's not really in a wheelchair, he's just faking it. And so like for this one they're like, well, if we can't have the same actor, maybe he'll be blind instead of a wheelchair and he'll be faking blindness.
To what end?
Right, because again, it doesn't make any sense that he's blind. It doesn't have any effect on the plot that he's blind. He just comes in and says, like, actually, Janet made me better. How? Why? Also, in a way that's, like, kind of fascinating. Like, if you had set up this world where people could be duped into believing that, like, there is a miracle worker in your midst who can just make everything better just by dint of being, like, this bizarre, fabulous woman.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of interesting. But the movie barely pays any lip service to Bert getting better. Like, they just like open the blinds and lightning strikes.
And
he's like, "Guess I'm good."
Why would it be Janet and not
Farley? Right.
Well, especially because the setup of Faith Factory, I don't think it goes far enough, but it was reminiscent to me of like televangelism.
Yeah, it is.
Right? But I actually just had this thought when we were talking about it. I think Bert's Now I Can See ploy occurs accidentally. Because I was paying attention during the shock treatment number. Someone knocks his glasses off. He looks startled.
Well, they step on them,
too. And then
too.
Someone steps on them while they're dancing.
No,
and then
Chris.
It looks like he commits to, like...
I think what it was is because, like, at that point, Machination had realized that he could see. So they take his glasses off and break them, forcing him to, like... be like, oh, I'm better now.
By the way, I just got the
Machination. Yeah, I know, right?
Machination?
Because Cosmo, they call him Mac, like McKinley. Mac and Nation.
Got it.
Because it's like, no, I have to tell you, I watched this entire fucking movie and be like, why is her name Nation? How does this make any fucking sense at all? And now I keep watching and be like, why is the nurse's name Anselong? What does that be? Like, is that a name?
Can you tell me why?
No, I can't.
Anselong.
A-N-S-A-L-O-N-G. Anselong. Like, it feels like it must be something.
It feels like it should be a pun.
Right, Nurse Anselong. I don't get it.
Nurse Anselong. Unless she has a first name we don't know.
I've never seen it. I've read the script for this
Pants
movie.
Pants along.
I'm sure that was it.
You know, she
went
got
it in one.
I mean, she used to wear long pants, and then she decided no more. I'm showing my ass to everyone.
Flapping my butt cheeks.
I also, my other question about Bert is he actually, like, the devil or something? Because, like, or is he an ancient lich? Or is he undead? I mean, like, his face is so insanely powdered.
It really is.
And his lips are horrifying.
Yeah. I mean, he looks...
They're very penciled, right?
His physical look is very, like, it's bizarre
his
and
hair
ghoulish.
Is shellacked.
It's, like, slapped to the side.
Yeah.
It looks like, I don't know, like, something Liza Minnelli would have done.
His movements are very big and theatrical, but they also seem sort of, I don't know how to say it, but, like, stilted and stiff.
Uh-huh.
Almost like he doesn't know how humans move. Like, I would have thought that would be the tee up for
Hugh
the Transylvanian.
There's also that hilarious bit in the lullaby song where every time they pan by his bedroom, everyone else is, like, doing things.
Or, like,
he's
sleeping.
Sitting on the bed
with
his... Go dopey smile.
Staring out the window.
Yeah,
it's bizarre. Like, it's hilarious, but it's also, like, ghoulishly weird.
But then when the next scene picks up, it's from a shot from behind him, still sitting in the same
position. Right, his alarm rings. Like,
his
alarm beeps. He turns it off, and he's still just been sitting there. Like, he's been sitting there all night just staring out this window.
It really makes you think maybe he's a robot, or, like, you know what I mean? Like, there's something up. I want to visit a question you posed to us a few times.
What's
over
that?
The two watches. No, I think it's a good one.
Okay.
Which was...
No, I'm asking you, what's that?
Is anyone fooled by the Brad Farley revelation.
Yes. Right,
because
it's the same actor.
It's the same actor, we see their faces. I mean, Lena, you were saying, we were both saying we felt like they do enough with Brad to kind
of throw
him off.
I think they do. I think he looks very different.
I do. I think that Cliff DeYoung does a very good job differentiating between the two characters. Like, Brad looks sort of, like, dopish, and he has poofy hair and enormous glasses. And Farley has, like, slicked back hair, and he's always sort of, like... Like, his jaw is kind of slack, and he looks, like, very, like, half-littered and apathetic.
Yep.
And he moves, like, very spastically and very big, whereas Brad's very, like, small and meek. And I think that probably helps. When I had seen this movie, I already knew that that was, like, a twist in it. Mm. So I knew from the get-go that obviously it was the same actor. I would just be interested in hearing if anyone, like, if audiences, when they saw this movie in 1981, were like, oh, that's just the same guy. Like, what's the deal here? I think it's very weird that they show you his face so often, and that Janet sees his face in the You're Looking at an Ace song. And then later, when she's doped up, she meets him in person. She's like, Brad, what made you realize this now, as opposed to not realizing it earlier? Like, if his
television.
Right. If, exactly. Right. Like, the camera does wonders with people's faces.
Yeah.
But if, like, if his face was never seen, like, if he was in shadows the entire time, and maybe I was thinking, like, I had in my head that, like, You're Looking at Ace was done with, like, with a cartoon mascot of Farley or something singing the song.
That would have been better.
That, like, at least you as the audience might not... Because, like, again, like, does the movie want you to take this as a twist? Like, does the movie want you to be surprised by this?
They treat it like one.
They do, but, like, also they show you him. So, like, I really can't tell what the intention is.
I think you could have gotten away with putting Farley in, like, really big 80s sunglasses, especially if you're going to sell...
That's probably true.
This, like, TV mogul thing. I did think the slackjaw thing was a really good touch when Cliff DeYoung was playing Farley, because you get the sense he's someone who's sat in front of screens a lot,
mm-hmm.
and has just become kind of this, like
ape. Yeah, like he's, like, late, like, his eyes are glazed over permanently.
Yeah.
Like, he just has no interest in any of it.
And he has these almost, like, simian reactions to what he's seeing, like, when he has this, like...
Oh, during Me of
that,
Me?
That, like, sexual freakout.
When he's, like, he, like, starts, like... orgasmic.
Yeah, make some O faces.
Yeah, he has an orgasm, and he's like, it's really terrifying.
There's a character I really want to talk about.
Who's that?
Really want to talk about Janet.
Okay.
It's a really badly written character, and I think Lee actually picked up on something that was true, that it feels like it is a gay man who has very poorly written a woman.
Yeah.
She's very dopey. She's very easily led and manipulated.
I mean, Brad is also, but you just don't get to see...
Right, well, Brad doesn't even have, like, anything to do in this movie.
Because he's robbed of all agency.
Right, he's, like, stuffed in a cage for the entire movie. So, like, Brad doesn't come off great just by dint of the fact that he's not physically present.
But I would argue...
But Janet obviously is... I assume Janet is the protagonist in this movie. Like, she must... Who else?
I think we're supposed to sympathize with Brad, and we're supposed
but
to
nonetheless,
like,
I'm saying
scorn Janet
but
for having, like,
protagonist. Yeah. She's the one we follow.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, it couldn't be, like, she undergoes a change.
Yeah.
Brad doesn't really
she
so
has an
much.
Arc.
For, like, no one also let like no one else in this movie really has an arc. Like, maybe Betty and Judge Wright, like...
The power couple that wasn't.
Yeah.
Quote-unquote, Lauren, when we're talking about Janet, I want to touch on that a little bit.
Yeah, the one thing I will say real quick, I think Jessica Harper is a good Janet. I like her. I like her singing voice a lot.
She has,
like, a very smoky, slow singing voice, which I appreciate. I think the issue is that Janet has nothing to work with, so, like, she has nothing to work with.
Yes.
But we've seen her, like, we've seen Phantom of the Paradise.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with her.
Yeah.
I think
the problem
singer
is the character.
I just don't find her to be a good actor, because I also thought she was pretty lackluster. I mean, she was a good singer in Phantom of the Paradise, but I thought she was pretty lackluster. But
she
it was
lacked
also,
luster, would you say?
She lacked luster,
okay.
For sure. But I mean, that's also a movie in which we had, like, Beef and Mr. Swan and...
Yeah, I think by dint of, like, Phoenix in that movie is, like, the least interesting character by dint of the fact that everyone is just so bizarre.
Right.
She's, like, kind of
normal.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyhow, you wanted to get into Oliver Wright and
Betty. Just wanted to touch on this element of the plot and how they treat it, like, they're detectiving out something.
Yeah.
But every one of their scenes is just them, like, sort of stumbling in on something. It just, like, sort of saying what happens versus actually doing it. Like,
right.
Oh, I think this is a conspiracy. Ah, yeah. So our show is canceled. Seriously. And then, like, they'll just be there, like, witnessing things and being like, ah, oh, interesting.
They're sort of there to put, like, a button on things and to, like, sum up what we saw.
Right.
I hate that line, because it wasn't macabre what they saw. It just wasn't. There wasn't any...
I do like... I think
it's
they
an
have a good...
angle.
Well, and I think they have good chemistry,
they
actually.
They do. They're really good characters. And I wish that actually made sense.
Right, no, I wish they had something
to
actually
they're
do.
They're not following any clues. It reminds me of, like, Kid Detectives, basically.
The next clue.
It's like the level of detectiving they're doing, like, for Washington Lane.
The White House!
Next clue is at the White House.
Next clue is at Denton Vale.
Yeah.
It would have been fun to actually see them put things together and
right.
discover things.
No, but they scope out the mental hospital to
right.
no end.
Right.
No end at all.
Well, that's the weird, because, like, they're sitting outside, but I'm like, what are you looking for? Like, I don't even know what they're trying to do. Or, like, you know, as we said, outside or maybe not outside, but they're looking into the windows. They're not looking, like, into the windows. They're looking down upon them. Like, what are you hoping to see?
Because I did think this part was interesting, that we are seeing, they travel a lot via the studio catwalks.
Yeah.
From which they can see over the walls of the different kind of, like, studio modular bits. I don't even know what to fucking call them. The sets. Thank you. So I guess that was a sort of an interesting element. But like you said, it doesn't... to no effect.
Right.
They don't use this information in an effective way.
Right.
They don't really give us anything we weren't already seeing. They just sort of restate things like a weird, bad Greek chorus. Like, it's not good.
I have to say, there are a lot of characters in this movie that don't add anything to the story. A lot of them, though, I do, like, I think a lot of the performances are kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think Richard O'Brien and Patricia Quinn are good as the McKinleys. I don't know what their deal is at all, but...
I don't either.
They're very watchable.
They are, and like, they're fun, and, like, everyone seems to have been directed to, like, well, just be as weird as you possibly can. Like, don't do anything the way a human would do.
Right.
Like, just, like, think of a strange way to do anything and do it.
Which I was kind of digging if we're trying to sell this, like, heightened TV reality.
Yeah.
Because one of the things I enjoyed was they use... like, soap opera announcing as a way to transition between some of the scenes of, like, and now we're back in Dentonville with...
Right, they use the little, like...
Majors.
And I like the use of music. Like, they use In My Own Way as sort of, like, this Dentonville music, like... Yeah.
The only other thing I wanted to touch on character-wise was Betty's ex-husband and what's-her-nuts.
Ralph.
And
Ralph and Macy Struthers.
Because Ralph struck me as an almost, like a QVC Ken doll, and she seemed very much like a pageant winner.
She looks like a Barbie, like,
right.
She, yeah.
And she talks like this.
Well, I sort of, like, it seems like
Macy's
everything
jealous.
Is so, like, facile and surface level. Like, it's just, like, there's nothing happening there, which I kind of like.
They're both animatronic.
Yeah.
Which I guess explains their hi.
Yeah, hi. Well, bye.
Speaking of yours, too,
yeah.
Betty.
No, you shove it too, Betty.
Oh, that's what it
By the way, that alimony line also makes no sense.
Alimony is just another word for rape.
Yeah, what does that mean?
It's a wild thing to
say. I guess it's just like... I don't know, man. I don't know. I thought I had it for a minute there that I lost
it.
It
doesn't even make sense because isn't it an alimony check for her?
Yeah.
So is she trying to say I'm raping him?
No, I think... Or maybe, like, she was raped. Like, she feels raped by him and the alimony is like a... I don't know. I was thinking, like, maybe the alimony is like a payment. I don't know.
You know what?
Man.
We are actually ignoring our own advice from the top of the show. We're trying to apply our logic to this, which is just not going to fly.
That being said, there are a lot of weird little tics that I appreciate in this movie that we talked about. Like, I notice it every time. Whenever they introduce Mac and Nation, they wave their pens in front, like, above their name tags. So they're doing it. And whenever they do it with Nation, she, like, smiles at the camera, like it just, like, loops along, like, put, like, very clearly putting on a show.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, there are a lot of weird little moments that make this movie for me. Like, as I had said to you before, this movie is, like, the sum of the parts is so much greater than the whole. Like, the whole is, like... It's nothing. I don't know what's happening here, but there are so many little things that I love in this movie.
But you liked that one woman that's, like, baffled by not being...
That's right! One of the cheerleaders are being like, give me a J!
Yeah.
Give me an A! We can't hear you! And there's this woman who, like, holds her hands out the funnel, like, what do you mean you can't hear me? I'm right here!
Us?
I'm shouting! What more could I possibly do?
How could you not hear me?
I also loved with those cheerleaders.
The onus of hearing is on you, my dear.
That during the Me of Me number, where Janet's having her big, I guess, like, coming out performance on, what was it, Denton?
The Breakfast Show.
The Morning
the
or whatever
show.
The fuck it was. You could see in the back after she's, like, completely proud the stage with a corded mic. You could, like, see in the back during the final moment of it that the cheerleaders are madly trying to, like, yank more
cord. They're pulling, like, the seat
so
on it.
Keep
moving.
I loved that detail
so
much.
No, yeah, there is, like, it's, I feel like this movie put its, like, focus entirely on those fun little touches at the expense of anything else.
I liked the touch of, I thought Janet's parents were the most obvious, like, Reagan supporters are gross kind of characters.
Yeah.
But I fucking love the sheer tackiness of the, like, the pink kipow top. Where she was like, they say it's Far East meets
the
Midwest.
Yeah.
Which was like...
Where she was like
mwah,
it's imported
mwah.
Fabric from Taiwan.
I thought that was wild. And I thought that kind of shared a relationship with one of the first moments of the movie, where we have Neely Doesn't she start the Denton
Yeah, she starts Denton
anthem,
USA.
Where
yeah.
she goes,
you'll find happy hearts and smiling faces and tolerance for the ethnic races in Denton.
It was such a beautiful, like, I thought that was actually pretty brilliant, and it hinted at something that never really surfaced.
No, I think that, like, hits exactly what it needs to hit.
Like, some actually pretty sharp criticism.
Right. Yeah. Like, yeah, like, we're all happy and, like, we're okay with the ethnic people here.
What racism?
Yeah, yeah, that's not a thing in Denton.
We're making their clothes.
Right. Yeah. So I want to say also real quick, just we haven't really gone into it too yet, but how this movie is weirdly prescient in a lot of ways about like the rise of reality TV. And given that this was done in 81 prior to Reagan being president, there was a whole lot of focus on like, you know, like the me decade and like, you know, like this is about me and my own self-interest and fuck anyone else. Like, you know, these sort of things that would not really happen yet. And while this movie like is throwing darts in every single fucking direction, like and just hits like all these targets that were probably like on the rise at the time, it's kind of impressive that it managed to nail a few of those things in such a distinct way.
Is that wisdom or was that luck, do you think?
I don't know. Like, I think it's probably a little column A, a little column B. Like, there's probably some, you know, we see that this might be a thing that's happening in the future, and a lot of just, like I said, you're hitting at every target, so, like, one or two of them are going to end up being real.
I don't mean to take away from Richard O'Brien, but I actually do think it was probably...
No, go ahead. It probably was.
I think it was more luck than foresight. I think he had a story he wanted to tell and where that landed.
Did he, though?
Well, I think one point in the 70s he had a story, then it kept molting and became the story.
Because in my mind, I
don't know that this is the one he wanted.
No, this is a story that he eventually got paid to tell.
But I mean, like, I think the story he told necessitated making a reality TV kind of thing. I don't think he had the idea of reality TV is going to happen in the future. I think that was accidental.
Yeah.
I think it's true. And I think it was also reflective of a lot of shit, like... I was also intrigued. There's the televangelism thing, but he wasn't preaching religion.
No.
It was a commodified version of mental health.
Right.
And
what is
that was super
interesting. What does he call it? Like, takeaway mental health or something?
Takeaways,
the idea that, like...
Yeah, something like
yeah,
that.
Like, the idea that, like, it's similar to, like, a fast food, like, restaurant where you could just, like, go in, you pay a small amount of money, and you get, like, this commodified, prepackaged idea of mental health, and, like, oh, you feel better now.
Which
now
is
you're
also,
good.
I think, a fucking interesting statement to say that, like... capitalism reaching such a level to where you just literally pay for a better mental health.
Yeah,
like,
and you get a mental health.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I really don't like the Bitchin' in the Kitchen song that much. I think it's dumb.
Trash can.
Obviously, it makes more sense in the original conception in which she is in the kitchen.
Right, they're in the kitchen.
She's in the bedroom.
Right, he's in the kitchen, yeah.
And they can't sing to each other, so they're singing to these inanimate objects about the fight they've just had. I don't hate that concept, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But as it exists in the movie, it's like they're singing to themselves, looking at the same TV screen that's playing, I think, an ad break, right?
Yeah, it's an ad break.
And it definitely changes it and takes it in a direction I'm also sort of interested in, of like, they're using these ads as a way to, like, channel their, like, marriage angst. And that's also kind of a, like, look at yourselves, America.
No, I do. It's like a weird little take on consumerism that, like, they're just focused entirely on the products while they're singing about their relationship.
What was her weird name for the alarm clock?
Micro-digital awaker.
Yeah. Fuck. He needed more syllables.
Yeah, I know, right?
Fucking say alarm clock.
He's gone through the rhyming dictionary and has rhymed with like everything with later. And it's like, fuck it, micro-digital awaker, there it is. There is an article I sent you guys on RogerEbert.com about like eerie visions of Donald Trump in shock treatment, and about how like in a weird way this was also kind of like Farley's kind of prescient of like the Donald Trump presidency, where like this guy comes in and tells you exactly what to think and you don't question what he says. And when he changes his mind, when he says initially like, you love Janet, Janet is the one you love. Who do you love? Janet. And then at the end he's like, no, get out. And everyone's like, yeah, we don't like you, Janet. Boo, down with you.
Now you love Macy.
Right, yeah. So it is terrifying that this is so relevant in a ways.
Yeah.
To me, like, it's upsetting that it's this relevant.
Yeah.
But it is also, again, like, either very clever or very lucky that it still somehow became relevant.
It works in reverse, too, because I don't think this was ever anyone's intention or anything anyone was thinking about this when they wrote it. Like I told you guys, it really is... very reminiscent of Dr. John R. Brinkley.
Yes.
Yeah. Who was like this quack scientist, like this quack doctor who would like, he initially was like just peddling his quack treatments, which was basically like putting goat nads on people. And it was like, now you're no longer impotent.
Good for you, buddy.
But then he would say that it cured everything. And then like, eventually he took on radio as a means to like peddle his wares.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually became way more popular on the radio than he had ever like, and eventually they kicked him out of the U.S. and he just put a radio tower in Mexico. which they were happy to oblige because Mexico got screwed out of like radio frequencies.
God, this fucking guy needs a movie.
Yeah,
I'm sure he's got like a documentary and a book. You could read all about him.
But, in your local library.
Yeah, like he would like.
No.
And he actually used like country music. He was the first person that broadcast country music on the radio, which was very popular with the people of the South. Mm-hmm. So like people fucking loved him.
Wow.
And were happy to buy whatever bullshit he would sell.
So it's just like it's a cyclical thing. Like this is simply the way of the world, right?
Yeah.
Like we'll never be rid of this monster.
Basically, it's just like an example of another like demagogue.
Yeah.
Just finds. Sort of accidental, like, because he just stumbles into, like, you know,
a way to, like, fleece rubes out of their money, basically.
And
yeah,
and he just seems to know what they want. Like, and all he does is find it and give it to them.
I have a question for you guys. Do you think, at the end of the day, this movie was just shot and they're like, we just have to finish this and, like, continuity and sense and coherency be damned. Like, there just needs to be, like, an end scene.
I think it was one of those things where, like, it had gone through so many revisions at a certain point, you start to forget, like, well, this made sense 5 drafts ago and, like, you sort of don't realize that, oh, we actually took out this part, like, 3 drafts ago.
Yeah.
So now it no longer makes sense in this version. But if you go back, it made a lot of sense then, trust me. When, like, you keep working on something for years and years and years, eventually, like, it just loses, like, toys, right?
Right.
It just sort of, like, loses the, like, whatever it was that you wanted to say initially, it becomes something entirely different. And sometimes, as with Shock Treatment, you get kind of lucky. You're hitting some targets along the way. But, like, you're also creating a whole lot of weird logical holes. I wanted to do Looking to Score as our last thing, where we just talk a little bit about the music of this movie, just sort of in general. So, it is a musical, as we had said. So there are, I think, about 15 or so songs and an overture in this movie. A lot of the songs... it's sort of interesting, they are very short. A lot of them are like just over 2 minutes in length. I think with the exception of Denton USA, which is the longest song in the movie, I want to say. Mm-hmm. A lot of these are very quick, which I think is odd from a musical to have so many numbers that are so short, but I think it also kind of keeps it moving fairly well. As we said, this movie is like a tight 90, so like it's just...
It's a tight 90 that feels much longer, though, because it's very flabby feeling when you're...
I feel like, for me, it lags around Looking for Trade is when it like gets very slow for me, I think. But I think also to be, like, I guess I don't want to say to be fair, but, like, Rocky Horror had the same issue for me, where around Planet Shmanet Janet, I'm just like, okay, like, I don't even know what the fuck is happening anymore. Fine, I'm just along for the ride. Do your fucking movie. I'm here watching you.
Yeah.
Maybe he just needs some help. But song-wise, I know we have differing thoughts on the general score to this movie.
Sure. We can do
soundtrack.
A quick walkthrough. Maybe.
Yeah, well, I mean, we don't have to hit up, like, every single song. But I like most of the songs in this movie a lot. I don't care for Little Black Dress. I think Thank God I'm a Man kind of sticks out because, well, I don't remember if I said this earlier, but you said that it seems out of place. And I think why it seems out of place is because we know that her father doesn't have much to do in the story, where he sings this song about how, like, how glad he is that he's a red-blooded American male and that it never, like, informs anything else he does ever again.
Faggots or maggots.
Thank God I'm a man. Right. So, like, you think that when you hear someone sing the song, it's like, oh, this guy's gonna, like, he's gonna have something to do in the story. Maybe he's an antagonist.
Right.
In some way, this will inform later events, and it never does.
No.
It's a fun, like, a fun, quote-unquote fun, like, little sort of slice of maybe what, you know, a red-blooded American might be thinking at that point in time.
I suppose.
But I don't think the story, like, needs that number.
I mean, but likewise, I just don't think the song is that good. I think conceptually I find it more attractive than I do the finished product, which is also true, the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
I like the Denton anthem.
I liked it, yeah. Denton, I think it's a very good opening number for the movie. I think it sets up a lot of things very well. I like the song Shock Treatment.
Love.
I like the Denton song. I like Shock Treatment, and I like...
Anyhow. Yeah.
Yeah.
The movie has a lot of, like, slower rock ballads, which is odd to me.
I don't, maybe you can put a name to it, but I don't mind the one that Janet's singing when she's leaving Brad in the asylum.
In my own way.
I don't hate that one.
I think it's very poorly shot. Because you're just watching Janet wander through halls for like 2 minutes.
But I think the song's fine.
I think, well, I never liked it at first. It was a song that I grew to like upon watching it again and again. And now I like it a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it's just like, it's a stagnant shot.
I think the Goodnight song is
dumb. Lullaby. I like Lullaby just because I like the way it's shot. Again,
yeah.
I don't get why it's here. I don't get why we care. I don't get what it has to do with anything.
Yeah.
It has a nice sort of like 80s rock sound, like a low-key 80s mm-hmm. rock sound to it that I like. Again, why is it in the movie?
Right.
But I think it looks and sounds neat.
I think my biggest problem is the composition, the music. I think the lyrics are mostly fine, but I think a lot of the songs sound very samey to me.
I do think that's true.
Yes.
I feel like there's not a lot in the way of orchestrations. I wonder if they had like a limited budget for instruments.
Yeah.
You got some guitars.
Right.
You got a couple of
horns. I also think the production, like the sound production is the mixing is not good.
It's not. I wonder how much of that is just like, we watched this on DVD because the Blu-ray only ever came out in the UK, so we can't watch it.
Everything but sounds kind of flat.
It does sound very tinny and sterile. So like, again, would this sound better on Blu-ray or would it not? I don't know.
But
it was low budget,
that, like,
so possibly
it musically
not.
Want to repeat themes, but I feel like it almost felt like, rather than repeating themes to carry a theme throughout the story, it was just like the guy didn't know, he only knew like a couple riffs. Because I feel like that came up every song was like, ba 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 ba. Yeah. That was like every peppy song had that bit.
I also felt that the three slow rock ballads I can think off the top of my head all sounded very similar. In My Own Way, Lullaby, and Looking for Trade. Looking for Trade's a little different, but those three all have, I think, the same core musically, where it's just this low bum 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 bum.
I think that's just Lullaby.
All three of them, though, because In My Own Way,
Looking for Trade has
the
like do 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 do
do do.
Yeah. Bum 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 bum
bum bum.
Yeah, that's not quite the same as Lullaby.
It's not.
No, but sorry, Lullaby and In My Own Way I found to be very similar. They both have the same like low thrumming guitar over people singing in a similar melody. I don't know. I found them to be close, but I'm also pretty not musically adept.
Yeah, I don't know. There are a lot of people who I've read online seem to prefer the soundtrack to Rocky Horror. I think there are things about that I certainly do like. I don't know if I would say that.
I think I like it in equal proportion to Rocky Horror.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think they're both, they have a lot of similarities. There are some songs in them that I think are very good, and there are other songs where I'm just kind of like,
I think the production on the Rocky
Horror
music is better.
I don't
remember anything.
I was going to say, like, I didn't expect you to.
But I probably wouldn't like the songs because I don't really like the subject.
But what about Meatloaf?
Yeah, Meatloaf comes
Would you
in.
Like Meatloaf?
I don't
Whatever
remember
happened
what
to you Saturday night.
But I don't really like Meatloaf so much as I like the people
I actually
who
do. Would you like Jim Steinman's writing for Meatloaf?
I actually do
well,
really,
sometimes I like other people writing for Meatloaf. There's
I actually do really
there.
Like his song in Rocky Horror.
No, I do too, but again, it's another case of like, why are you singing this?
Right, I know. But Whatever Happened to Saturday Night, it's a fun song.
No, it is. And I think a lot of the songs are like fun songs. It's just, it's always such an interesting musical choice. Like Richard O'Brien doesn't seem to have like a strong sense of how to write a musical. Like he has like an idea, but he doesn't really necessarily know how like the song should inform the plot. Indeed, in here, he basically constructed a plot around the songs. Like he basically made a jukebox musical for songs that don't exist.
Yeah.
Which
that
is
were not,
bonkers.
That were unreleased at the time.
Yeah. So I think we've covered everything that we wanted to talk about. And we wanted to get into fixes at this point. Does anyone want to go first?
I'll go first.
All right.
I found myself not changing the plot very much. But I mean, I think what it needs is simplification. We're doing away with the twin shit. It doesn't really help the plot, in my opinion, and it's so tacked on at the end that it doesn't matter, really. Farley has always owned DTV, but it's been like a slow creep. Like, you kind of see it coming up from being like public access, and then it's just getting bigger and bigger until it's become more of a, not just Denton, but I'm going to say it's like a regional conglomerate, but it's maintaining the Denton image, and that's the sort of like image that it's bringing through to all of its programming, so that part's kind of the same. We're making it explicit that there is a town, there's a place outside of the studio, and there's a place inside of, like, and then there's the inside of the studio. The thing I really want to push is keeping the tight timeline of having it be sort of like a day or two of this really crazy wind-up
production.
Yeah,
it's like 36 hours, this movie.
Right. Which I don't hate, because I actually think
no,
it's
I don't either.
Story, but I think I want to kind of really punch in on the idea that it's this almost like all-consuming media monster that is reaching out and slowly taking people in. I think I would want to have more of an arc happening where like audience members are going missing because they're all being kind of sucked into these different game shows and somehow being committed to the asylum. The asylum in this case is still going to be for reality TV show purposes, but is not in the actual studio. That's going to be a separate location. I hate the fact that it's in the same place as Happy Homes. I keep the musical aspect, I guess you could probably keep most of the songs. They would just need to be rearranged. But in my mind, it's the same basic adventure, but you just fill in the details that you need. So we get an idea of actually who Bert is, what Marriage Maze is, what his weird cooking show shit was. I think you can really go in more of like what the programming was for DTV and have fun with that. So you could even bring that through the plot of like, my thought was that maybe somewhere in the third act, Brad and Janet kind of break out before the finale, but it kind of, they're running through all of these different kind of like crazy sets and like
Pee Wee's Big Adventure.
Right. But like, but like the shit is like happening live. And I think that would be a good way to kind of like throw a lot of things out there and give these kind of crazy moments that the movie wants to give you.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to go with this idea of it just being this, like, completely black-hearted satire of, like, 80s America and Reaganomics and all that shit. Because I think there is shades of that, but I want more. I want it to be blatantly about consumerism, blatantly about supply-side economics, and I really want to make it more of Brad and Janet's marriage weren't working out because they were being consumed by the material goods in their life and the TV and this shit that doesn't really matter, and that they kind of had to get sucked in to realize that.
So, in my version, it is not an actual sequel to Rocky Horror in any way, shape, or form. It's still set in Denton, because, like, maybe you're doing musicals about, like, Denton, and, like, you're using this as a backdrop for whatever you want to say. Like, Rocky Horror, you're talking about, like, 50s sci-fi and, like, glam rock and all that sort of thing. For this one, you're talking about consumerism in the 1980s in America and, like, this sense of self-identity. And, you're like, who knows what you want to do next? Like, set it there. So, Janet's parents are cut. Farley isn't Brad's brother. Called the main couple Brenda and James just because I wanted to, like, name swap, like, that's it, pretty much it. Sure. Like, there's a B and a J. That's what I got for you. Brenda is a mid-tier employee in her local hometown's TV station, Denton TV. Her love interest, James, is a lower-level employee, like a gopher or something. The movie is about them getting together. They're not a married couple rediscovering their love or something, I guess. Bert is a weird Oprah/Donahue type. Denton Vale is an inspiring real-life TV show that discusses mental health, starring the weird but watchable married doctors Cosmo and Nation McKinley. Barney, formerly Ralph, and Macy head up Denton Doings, which is a facile, empty show full of cheap human interest stories about, like, you know, like, old men who feed ducks all day, and, like, how sad is it that this old man feeds ducks?
Yeah.
And Denton Dossier is a community-themed TV show investigating things about the town, featuring Rhonda, who was formerly Betty, and Judge Oliver Wright. Their station has been bought by the omnipresent business mogul Farley Flavors, a multimillionaire whose tendrils have already spread throughout many other aspects of life, food service, property, charity, business school, etc., and now looks to reach everyone every second of every day through a cable TV network. He's launching his initiative in Denton because he thinks it's a good entry point. Rhonda warns her BFF Brenda that she is suspicious of Farley's intentions, but Brenda doesn't buy it. She and James meet with Bert, who claims to offer them advice on how to navigate through the dangerous waters of workplace dating in the 1980s, but just ends up confusing them more. This is probably going to be done through song. He suggests James gets deeper in touch with his emotional side by spending more time with Cosmo and Nation in their Dentonville show, and Brenda assists Barney and Macy with their show to learn more about the way her workplace will change once Farley takes over entirely. This starts to split the two apart as both parties advise James and Brenda in different ways. Oliver and Rhonda find that Farley has canceled their show, and the two immediately set out to discover what the deal is. They find out that Farley views Denton as a bunch of rubes and thus a good entry to his world dominance of multimedia networks so that he can be constantly piping his influence to people 24/7 today, Denton TV, tomorrow the world. Meanwhile, Brenda has been made over by Barney and Macy to be a focal point in Farley's new mental health initiative, pumping slick and easily digestible blobs of feel-good vagaries to the masses to make them more susceptible to him and his ways of thinking. There's nothing wrong with you. Everyone else is making your life more miserable, and you just need to dig your heels in and keep being more you. Brenda buys into this through the flashy promises of Farley, Macy, and Barney. James is driven through a mental loop by Nation and Cosmo, which makes him feel as though he's not man enough for Brenda, who will inevitably leave him for a real man. In the end, Farley asks Brenda live on his primetime special to marry him and live a life of pointless 80s decadence, thus becoming the real her. She's about to answer when James bursts onto the scene. He saw her on TV and decided to make an aggressive display to get her attention by showing up Farley. Before anything else can happen, Oliver and Rhonda reveal Farley's scheme live on TV. Brenda realizes she's been duped by Reagan-esque nonsense and tells Farley that this is her true self, the one who's meant to be with James. James realizes that all the aggressive posturing was a load of macho nonsense and that he was happy just being with Brenda, sans any involvement from Cosmo and Nation. Farley, enraged, tells the viewing audiences that now they don't like Brenda or James or Oliver or Rhonda, and they all agree with him. They also decide that they don't care if he thinks that they're rubes because he promises them a better life of self-absorption. The four leave the studio having come to their own realizations through their own assistants about who they are, while meanwhile Farley's ratings skyrocket and the crowd demands he runs for president so that he can keep telling them what to think and how to be. It's also all still set in the TV station, because I like that a lot.
Space A, I liked it.
Alright, I don't have much. I'm gonna detach it from the real world and sort of Streets of Fire it and just have this...
Yes!
It takes place in, like, an ambiguous time, but that's, like, roughly 80s in an ambiguous town, mm-hmm. and not really... And, like, sort of detached from any connection to real-life politics or history. But I kind of want to... I mean, I really latched on to the John R. Brinkley thing, and I also latched on to wanting to focus more on the Judge and Betty.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of doing, like, a John R. Brinkley story where, like, Farley is... I'm sort of combining him, melding him with the quack doctor. So I'm going, like, this idea that, like, he's positing mental health, but, like, he's this sort of quack doctor figure that has stumbled on, like, pirate TV technology to sort of, like... spread his ideas and, like, get people to buy into his shit. And he's just very popular with, like, the common man. And Denton is like the town, it's currently on the fringes of his influence, and like he's been doing this for a while, like his station's pretty popular, and like at the beginning of the movie is like he's got his transmitter is now able to like access Denton, so like it's sort of the beginning of like his ability to influence this new town. The judge, I think, is a disgraced doctor who tried to discredit Farley before, but who got like shot, like he basically like one-upped like by the fight and ended up getting disgraced falsely himself, and so he sort of like ran away to Denton to like hide.
Is he still a judge?
No, he's probably still just the doctor.
Okay. I'm loving this backstory though.
Yeah. And so he's like he was able to at least live where people, you know, his away from the sort of like shattered reputation that he had, and relatively outside of Farley's influence until like the beginning of the movie where it's back in. And he's like, the way that I kind of want to have their partnership work is that he's very good at putting things together, but he's not good at finding things or noticing things. Mm-hmm. Whereas Betty, doesn't have like the knowledge, but she has like the instinct to like, to know like where to go, like what to look for, etc.
Street smarts.
Yeah. Like the street smarts. Mm-hmm. So she's able to like be the sort of detective, and then he's able to take that information and like come up with something, synthesize like information with it. And then Brad and Janet are just, like, basically, like, some of the first victims to this new, like, you know, system that takes place. Like, there is this show, I think the basic concept holds true, where, like, they, like, make an example out of Brad, by, like, putting him on this marriage show. I do think Bert is still kind of, like, his Goebbels figure, that's, like, the face of his technique, and, I don't think it takes place all in the studio. I think that, like, there are cameras that can just go wherever they need to go, and that's how they get filmed everywhere. But I think, yeah, that Brad is basically still falsely accused of, like, having issues and, like, committed against his will and kind of, like, you know, drugged up and have harm genuinely done to him to, like, make him appear like he's nuts. And because you already know, like, the judge or the doctor already knows that Farley's full of shit, it's just a matter of, like, him and Betty working together to find a way to actually stop him. And it's less about, like, you know, figuring out that he's evil, and more like, how do you take down this guy that A, everyone loves, and B, he's actually very savvy and knows how to work around the law very well, similar to how Brinkley was, and have the ending be like, instead of this, like, these people escape, I want the ending to be that they find a way to discredit him, and the fight's not over because, like, people still love him, even though, like, you know, you could, even when you take down someone, people are, he's a demagogue and people will still love him, but at least, like, the initial, there's a reason to celebrate in that, like, he can't continue forward in his quest, like, he's been stopped, and now there's still steps to go to, like, undo the conditioning and brainwashing is onto everyone, but
I like it.
In the very least, like, you know, his progress towards, you know, taking over society has been stopped.
When you were describing it that way, I had two thoughts, and it's sort of like, it's almost like Brinkley, but as the Wizard of Oz in a way. If he's this, like, pretender who's taken on this mantle of leader. But it's also sort of, I mean, I haven't seen it, but from what I understand of The Music Man, is it sort of like...
You've never seen The Music
Man? What?
Wait, time out!
What? That's not what The Music Man's about at all, though!
That's insane!
It's really not that old.
You need to see The Music
Man's
first
nice
of all.
Guy,
yeah.
Okay?
I think also the thing with The Wizard of Oz is, too, is, like, he is kind of a nice guy, too. Like, he's a fraud, but he's, like, a nice guy.
Hey, I was literally going to ask you if you'd seen it over the course of the summer.
I haven't. We'll have to.
Let's watch it.
Now that I know that Chris has not seen The Music Man, all right. We're going to do...
By the way,
treatment style. We're going to put him in a wheelchair, drug him,
the
and make him watch
this. The listeners of this podcast... cannot see the wide eyes of disbelief.
I mean, I am legitimately shocked you've never seen The Music Man.
God, we're gonna have a sing along with The Music Man this week.
I'll tell Rich. Rich wants to see it again too. Oh. So, like, we'll do this. Hey, Chris, do you still have the Wikipedia open?
Yes.
I'm curious. How much did this make?
Here's the problem. It says that it was a commercial failure.
I'm sure it was. I was just curious what the numbers
were. And it never received a full general theatrical first.
Oh, really?
But it's not telling me how much money it actually
is. So, because the thing I do know about this is that Fox basically put this in theaters on Halloween and was like, here's another cult movie for you to enjoy. And people were like, not so much. So, like, in a weird way, I feel like this movie was sort of DOA to begin with. Because, like, as is witnessed by this, you can't make a cult movie. A cult movie just sort of has to happen.
It's like how you can't knowingly make camp. It has to.
Well, I mean, but, like, doesn't John Waters knowingly make camp?
That's a good point.
I don't think that's true with Kim. I've heard that said before, and I disagree with it. Anyhow. But, so, it's sort of interesting to me that, like, that we also talk about this movie was billed initially as, like, not a prequel, not a sequel, but an equal, mm-hmm. which just feels like Fox is, like, throwing their hands up in the air being like, we told you it was going to be a sequel. We realize now it's not a sequel. I get it.
It's like it.
Yeah, it's sort of like the first movie, but not really. Because, like, also, just... this movie would have never been made if it had not started out as a sequel to Rocky Horror, but, like, at the end of the day, Fox really just should have been like, you know, like, let's not stretch this. Like, let's just be like, from the people who gave you Rocky Horror, another weird musical. But, like, it's so weird, right? Because Rocky Horror is, like, fun, and it encourages you to dress up, dance, and, like, lower your inhibitions.
It's a midnight movie experience.
Right, where this is more like telling you that things are bad.
Yeah.
And, like, things in the world are bad, and you can't escape from the bad influence of the bad things.
I think it's also a thing of Rocky Horror is, like, it touches the theater kid in you kind of deal, because it is a very kind of, like, theater kid thing
to be super into.
I also think it tends to...
But I also
I think people tend to feel more passionately about it because it is more openly professing a very kind of queer...
It is.
Viewpoint.
Yeah.
Whereas I am attracted to the dark things Shock Treatment is kind of saying sometimes, but I find it less accessible because its message is not clear, and additionally, it is not as cohesive an idea or a feeling as Rocky Horror is.
I think it's at times funny, but it's not always fun.
Yes.
Like, there are times where I'm like, oh, this is an entertaining little weird line of dialogue you have, but at the end of the movie, I'm just kind of like, ugh.
But there were
but it's so happy.
Like, it is such a happy ending, but then you also have, like, the reprise of Denton as they're all wearing their straitjackets.
I know.
Singing, like, they've all, like, willingly committed themselves to Dentonvale, like, just celebrating.
Which is why all the doctors are dancing around and money showering on them. They just made money off the whole town committing themselves to their...
I honestly never interpreted it as the town, like, literally is going to lock themselves up just so much as it was, like, more of a metaphorical statement on, like, where they were.
By the way, it could very well
be. I know, it could be. That was always just my thought. So, would you recommend it?
Yes. I think it's fun to watch. I don't know that I would suggest someone go into this thinking, like, oh, this is going to be my new favorite cult movie.
Well, I would also say don't go in thinking this is a sequel to Rocky Horror.
No.
Absolutely not.
It's all right.
But I think it's all right. I think it's watchable. I think it's an interesting watch.
Yeah.
I found myself... pulled in by things. So yeah, I'm gonna say yes. Go watch it.
This has its own sense of weirdness that I've never really seen in another movie.
It does, for
like,
sure.
It's its own sense of self. So I like that. Like I said, it's a tight 90, which we don't get a lot of. Like, regardless of how well you feel it's plotted, it is in fact 90-some minutes long.
Yeah.
Like, look at your clock, look at the sun in the sky, you will see that only 90-some minutes have passed from the time you started watching this. So I think
But only when you see that sun.
Yes.
And looking at the
no, clock, don't watch it at night because you look up in the sky and say, oh my god, has the dragon eaten the sun again? Bang on your pots and pans, children.
I just have a really quick question. Did you prefer this movie over what you remember of Rocky Horror?
I mean, she says, like,
I said that.
Leah said that, yeah, she did. I do think if you watched Rocky Horror now, you would still be like, what is this and why should I care?
I don't like Rocky Horror. I just know that I don't.
Yeah. I feel like you could watch Rocky Horror now and you would still be like, well, Shock Treatment was more enjoyable to me.
Yeah. And when I watch Rocky Horror, I just imagine me being forced to, like, get sexed up and I don't want to.
We're going
to
draw a V on your forehead.
Yeah.
For vagueness.
Oh, I see.
No, for virgin.
Oh, right. And they do the whole, all the virgins stand up.
Yes.
And fuck you. Yeah. It's been a long time. Okay,
it's,
guys.
Yeah.
It's been a long time. It's been almost 10 years.
All right.
We don't need to talk about it.
Now that we've covered all of 1981 Shock Treatment, you can go on our website, www.dratpack.com. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/whywatchpodcast. That's about all I've got for you there. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a mini episode.
Anybody, we're gonna do it with anybody. We're gonna do it with anybody.
We just gotta keep going. The sun never sets on those who ride in space.
The sun never sets on those who ride into it.
We just gotta keep going.